Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. We're approaching the second weekend in October, and on many Fairbanks social calendars, Hi-Pow looms large. This year marks its 50th anniversary as a fundraiser. Nancy Cook Hansen looks back on it and her life in education.
Father McGuigan died in June, and unexpectedly, Bishop Kinnicky died in August. And I know people were really concerned, and you know, what's going to happen? Hi-Pow's not going to make it. And my response to that was, that's not fair to him and to his legacy, because what he did was set it up so that it could function without him.
Also on the show, a new book and exhibit celebrates Alaska's botanical bounty.
My choice is to almost recreate, in a sense, the feeling of the older botanicals that come from the pages of books. So that quality, I think, ends up in my final drawings.
Artist Karen Stomberg, I hope you'll stick around. Hi-Pow stands for Happiness is Paying Our Own Way. Father Francis McGuigan started it 50 years ago to support the Catholic schools of Fairbanks. Since then, it has become a landmark for Fairbanks and statewide social and political calendars. Perhaps no one associated with the event is better known than Nancy Cook Hansen. She recently retired as director of the schools and the Monroe Foundation after decades at the helm. I sat down with her in early summer to find out what's in store for her and how she came to join the school originally. To be transparent, I got to know Nancy when I worked for the Catholic Diocese of Fairbanks. As you'll hear, she's a born and bred Fairbanksan.
Well, for me, it was a great place to grow up. I grew up just down the street from the schools. I'm the fifth of the six children. So by then, my three brothers, my older sister had gone through school, and kind of a precedent had been set that you would be a good student, and that's kind of what we were. My parents were great about letting my sisters and myself participate. Women's sports were just coming to be, so we got to do that. Sometimes it was difficult to be, oh, are you so-and-so's daughter or so-and-so's younger sister, but most of the time it was a joy. And, you know, it was, you know, at that point in time, I never thought of the family, anything other than family. We just, we were blessed to be where we were, who we were, and to live in a neighborhood where everybody took care of one another. And, it was just actually a lot of fun.
Are there strong or vivid memories you have of those days?
Oh, sure. One of my favorite memories is I grew up in Slaterville. So when I was quite young, we still had wells and septic systems. So when they started putting in the water systems, and the streets were always dug up, it was great places to play. And so adventures, you know, crawling through all the ditches and stuff, that was a lot of fun. Neighborhood games, hide and seek, and that were fun. The flood was an interesting time in 67. That was just before my freshman year in high school started, and our neighbors owned ski land, and so much of our neighborhood went up to ski land and spent the week up there.
Well, you talk about going into Lathrop for your freshman year. Did you know you were going to be an educator when you were growing up?
At some point in time, I remember wanting to be either a doctor or a nurse, but then the sight of blood and different things really bothered me. I thought, that's not the way to go. And then I think shortly after high school, maybe even when I was in high school, playing basketball had become a big something I really enjoyed. And I had the opportunity, really, Title IX was, you know, just coming into effect. And so women's sports were growing. And I liked working with younger kids and helping them to learn the game, which actually helped me learn the game better. We didn't have the best of coaches in the 70s. So when I got to the university, then I started having some very good coaches. And I think that's probably when I realized teaching was part of what I like to do. I had spent a lot of time, the three older brothers are quite a bit older than I am, and they came back to town with their wives and started families. So I spent a lot of time with my older nieces and nephews. I'd get to babysit them. The youngers, I didn't spend as much time, but that the first 8 or 9 or so, I had a lot of time with them. And so some of that babysitting time, I think, might have informed me as, oh, maybe teaching is a... And my older sister had become, was a teacher. And so I think that all factored in.
Mm. Where did you go to college?
Oh, well, my college story is a little bit odd. My mom had this thing that all of her children would go to school back east. And my older sister was then living in New Hampshire. So I applied to University of Vermont and a couple other schools there. And so I was accepted at University of Vermont. So I thought, okay, I'll go to University of Vermont. And I liked it, but it was too far away. At the same time, oddly enough, I was going through quite a search of what's the meaning of life. And that factored in a lot. And I can remember one of my dad's close friends died when I was at University of Vermont. And I felt really badly for my folks. I mean, he was a good friend of our family. And I can remember just thinking, maybe I'm going to pray, but I don't really know what prayer is. And so I thought, well, okay. I wrote my folks and said, could I just please come back to the University of Alaska? And in fact, could I live at our cabin at the lake for a year and just take correspondence courses? Much to my surprise, they said okay.
Wow.
So then I came back to the University of Alaska and lived at Harding Lake for a year, did some correspondence classes, went up to the university for classes and lived at the lake, where it was great fun to go out on cold, dark nights and lie on my back on the lake, frozen lake, and drift into the Milky Way and the Northern Lights. And I did not necessarily figure out the meaning of life.
That would be but, the bonus thing for our interview.
I knew I was on a search, and I didn't really know where the search was going to take me. And it took me quite a while to end that search. But and then in the process of being at the University of Alaska, they formed the first official intercollegiate women's basketball team. And so I had the opportunity to be on that team and formed many wonderful friendships. And I don't know, it was 5 years ago or so, we celebrated the 40th year since the first intercollegiate women's basketball game. So, and I earned my degree in history, had the opportunity to also then student teach, and student taught at Lathrop when it was East Lathrop and West Lathrop, all running out of the one building there.
Wow.
Student taught at one and substitute taught in the other one. And when I graduated, had an opportunity to begin teaching, but I thought that I should not teach in Fairbanks right away. So I went to Delta, really far away.
Far away.
Where I also had an apartment, but I commuted a lot and lived at Harding Lake again.
I want to ask you about the lake. I know it still occupies an important place in your life. Did the family have it, the cabin there?
So this is, I think, a great story. My folks bought the cabin in 1943. They didn't have a car, and they either rented a car or got there with friends, and you had to walk the last couple of miles in at that time. And so they had my three brothers. My sister hadn't yet been born. So mom would go out there with a couple of friends who had cabins nearby and spend most of the summer with the older boys, and then dad would work. So when I came along, by the time I was 4, which would have been 1957, there was evidence that there was something going on with my heart. And they had a doctor who actually was not an official doctor in the United States. She was from Poland and had survived the concentration camps.
Yikes.
But for whatever reason, mom and dad knew her, trusted her, believed in her, and they also used doctors in town, but the thing was, they said I should live away from the rest of the family, have quiet. So the choice was for mom and dad either to rent a place in like the Northward building or the Polaris, or mom and I could live at the lake and dad would take care of the other kids. So mom and I lived at the lake from February of 1957 through the summer. And when you think about that, we had no electricity, no running water, and a wood furnace, no phone. And so she took care of me out there. We obviously had lots of quiet. Dad would come out at least once a week maybe twice. And the boys, you know, and Dad would cut enough wood for Mom and help bring in water. Sometimes she had to go out in the lake and bring in the water herself. She'd bundle me up and set me in the window so I could see her. To entertain me, she had me write letters to the grouse, and she'd put the letters out under a Hills Brother coffee can out by the outhouse, and the grouse would write back. So I think for me, even more so than, although all six of us have a strong affinity for the lake, I had a really strong affinity for that place. So, and I inherited the cabin, so that's kind of nice too.
Did you join the faculty here right out of college?
No, I went to Delta for a year.
That's right.
I taught junior high in Delta, which was on Fort Greeley. So I taught there and coached the boys' basketball team, which was a lot of fun. And the boys weren't certain at first that they should have a female coach, but we worked through all that, and that was a lot of fun. But then I took a year off to travel with some friends. I traveled for a few months and then went back to college again and finished off a few things. And then I went back to Delta and taught in the high school. In high school and the elementary school, and then taught the girls' basketball team. And I was all set to go back to Delta, and I got this phone call from, and I can't remember if it was from Cliff Berglund, John Hajdukovic, or George Sundborg, but George, that group of three said, we'd like to take you to lunch and talk to you about the possibility of coaching at Monroe. So I said, oh, it was kind of flattering to have people call. So I said, okay. So I went to lunch. George Sundborg was the leader of the crew, and we talked about the possibility of coaching at Monroe, and it had never even occurred to me. I was very, they knew me since I was little, so they knew I wasn't Catholic. They presumed that I was probably a practicing Mormon, though I had kind of quit the Mormon church when I was in high school, but they knew, and I said, well, okay, I said, be happy to talk to the principal and learn a little bit more. And so I just ended up, I don't know what all happened, but when I talked with the principal, I told him, my degree was in history, my minor in math, that I'd much prefer teaching those than PE, and that I would be willing to coach the girls' basketball team, which had been 0-22 the year before. And I could also coach volleyball.
So, well, you couldn't do any worse than that.
Well, I had one friend who advised me to make sure they didn't schedule 23 games so that we wouldn't be 0-23. So I made that request. I said, 22 games only, and we've got it. And so then I felt badly not going back to Delta because I'd formed friendships there. But there'd been a couple incidences in my dad's health, and I just said, okay, I'm going to come back. Little did I know how long I would be here.
This is Northern Soundings, and I'm talking with Nancy Cook Hansen, the recently retired director of the Catholic Schools of Fairbanks. This coming weekend marks the 50th anniversary of HiPow, the fundraising event for the schools. When we return from the break, stepping into big shoes. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This episode, I'm speaking with Nancy Cook Hansen, recently retired director of the Catholic Schools of Fairbanks. This coming weekend marks the 50th anniversary of HiPow, an event that supports the schools. Nancy joined the schools as a teacher in 1979, and I asked her how the school had changed since that time.
It was very different physically. The building that we're sitting in wasn't here at that time. They had just hired a religious sister, Sister Eileen Brown, who was a Holy Name sister, to be the director of schools. And so she would be responsible for the schools, kind of bringing the elementary school, Immaculate Conception School, and the high school together and working them. There was a transition going on then where the Jesuit volunteers were no longer going to help staff the schools. And so there was a transition to bringing in more lay people. And the elementary school, the two-story elementary school, had just been built. There was quite a debt to pay off for that. Father McGuigan ran the Monroe Foundation, so he was, you know, his primary responsibility was helping with funding the school, but also paying off the building of that, the two-story building. So Sister Eileen was kind of new. I mean, obviously hadn't been in Fairbanks before, and and she was a total gift to my life in terms of helping me understand more about, you know, what it meant to be a Catholic school. We were pretty sort of far-flung faculty in a way. It was really going to be important to bring us together as a group to have a common mission. There was a new principal of the high school. The person who hired me, Bill Cooper, was retiring, so the principal of the high school is coming in. So there was lots to learn. And there were only 80 students in the high school at the time. So there was a lot of building to do, and it all worked out. And so for me, it was, you know, I started off coaching right away with the volleyball season and got to know the kids pretty well, and they were very welcoming, and there began the story.
Yeah. Before I go to that story, I want you to reflect a little bit about teaching, because I think it's a very hard job. People don't appreciate how difficult it can be. And what do you think the set of skills that allowed you to thrive in that environment? What does it take to be a good teacher, do you think, Nancy?
You know, there's an obvious piece of really liking young people and being curious about them and what they're interested in. I don't know that I necessarily consider myself to be a good storyteller, but I think the ability to be able to tell stories and relate whatever it is you're teaching to what might be happening for kids in their lives is really important. And that can happen in a math class, can happen in a while coaching, and it can happen in a history class. Those two pieces tied together, I think, are very important. You know, and just being able to welcome kids into a classroom and have an excitement for, hey, it's great to see you today. Thanks, you know, thanks for being here, type of excitement. And I'm much far more comfortable with high school students than I am with elementary school students.
Well, what was your first administrative post at the school?
Well, in some ways, so I taught for 4 years, and the person who was hired at the same time I was Steve Frank, and Steve was hired to coach the boys' basketball team, and he served as athletic director. He had a full-time job. He was also a banker, had a full-time job. And so he kind of kept that athletic director position for a couple of years, but then it was sort of difficult for him. And so I did some of that work, but at the time we only had, you know, boys and girls basketball, girls volleyball. We started cross-country running, and we were thinking about track. So I started helping with some of the scheduling of games and, you know, how do you get from here to there when you're traveling, doing some of that work, thinking about a little bit more about who do we want to have as different coaches. But then in 1983-84, I ended up becoming principal of the high school.
Now, the way you describe it, it's sort of like it just fell on you and suddenly you woke up one morning, but it couldn't be like that.
The person who had been principal left, I think, to go work in one of the villages. The school at the time, you know, salaries weren't great. I think it had become evident that I had a commitment. In the process, in February of 1982, I had become Catholic. I went through sort of my own individual RCIA program with Sister Eileen and Father Loynes. So I think that that sense of commitment, that sense of understanding of curriculum and maybe some of the needs of the school. And Sister Eileen and Bishop Whalen had worked together with University of San Francisco to have me begin a course of studies, summer course of studies there through a program that they had called the Institution for Catholic Education Leadership. University of San Francisco as a Jesuit university, so Bishop Whalen had ties to that. So I began that program in 83. And so it was kind of learning on the job. And Sister Eileen Brown had been principal of Holy Names schools before, so she was a great assistance to me in kind of figuring out how do you, you know, what to do, how to become, you know, a principal. So it was, again, learning on the job.
I think being a Catholic school must be very challenging today, because externally, you're a private school in public education. So any, for example, in the Knowles administration, there was concerns about busing kids to Monroe, and somehow that was complicating church and state issues. Internally, of course, many people who think about Catholic education, who went through Catholic education as a youngster, as I did, think of it taught by a religious order. And so to have laity be involved in it is a difficult kind of issue. All of those tensions must have come into play here. What was your experience of all that, Stu?
That's a very true description of what was happening. The Jesuit priests, other than Father Pepin, who stayed with us quite a while, were gone by the time I came in 79, and the Jesuit volunteers were also leaving. There were a number of religious sisters still here, but they did not stay real long, though up through maybe the 80s and early 90s, we did have a few sisters. And that was a challenge, because people did look at the school and say, is it really Catholic? And how do you define Catholic? And I didn't fully understand that statement. It took me a long time to learn what that meant. How were we connected to the diocese? How often were we able to celebrate Mass? At the time, only place that was large enough to have a school Mass was in the gym, and so it took setting up. So Masses might be once a month, if that. And so there was lots of question, is the school really Catholic? And we did our best with that to make certain that we were. But again, you know, that was difficult. And we often had, up until the late 90s, we had religious sisters as principal of the elementary school. I think that was helpful. Bishop Kanicki had a big hand in sort of helping us, in helping me in particular understand what concerns were. He and I often had a little bit of a rocky relationship, but by the mid-90s, we had become friends and were working together. And he's the one who had the dream of a chapel that would be sit between the elementary school and the high school and would be the face of the school. And that he had been back to his Jesuit school in Detroit, Michigan, and he'd come back in the late 90s with this dream. And so, you know, he helped us with the fundraising, and we had wanted to do an addition to the school because the old part of the old section was just really creaky old. I mean, there was mushrooms growing under floors and all sorts of stuff. So it had to be
great
done.
Great for biology, not so much for other
things. So we forged ahead, and then, you know, the building was complete in April of 2000. It was a magnificent effort, again, of community working together. And then in April of 2000, we had the official consecration of the new chapel. And then Father McGuigan died in June, and unexpectedly, Bishop Kanicki died in August. And then once again, it's, what do we do? And one of Bishop Kanicki's last pieces was to connect. We used to have two boards, a school board and a foundation board. And he had hired a consultant who said, you need to have one board that works together to provide for both the school and the fundraising piece. And so he had done that. And so there was sort of all this work to do, and, you know, that he left us with. But he also had provided with this beautiful center that we now needed to fully integrate into the school. And that's how the 2000 started.
Mm. It strikes me that this job also is demanding, because you have to be a top flight fundraiser. Talk to me a little bit about the birth of HiPow and the challenges of being both an administrator and a fundraiser.
Well, HiPow started in 1970, so we're just getting ready to celebrate the 50th HiPow. And that was started by Father McGuigan when he didn't he wasn't working fully for the schools then. Father McGuigan had a very interesting career too. When he came to Fairbanks, he started at Monroe and he coached and taught at Monroe and was principal of Monroe and then was also at the cathedral, but he was a full-time counselor at West Valley High School, at both Maine Junior High when Maine was here and at West Valley High School.
Interesting.
So he had strong ties to the community, which is so important. And then he was asked to help fundraise for the schools in 69-70. And he knew of Bellarmine Jesuit School in Tacoma, Washington, had an auction. So he adapted their auction and brought it to Fairbanks in 1970. And the families at this, of the school at the time, you know, worked on that. And we still have a few of the families who are going to be working on the 50th. They started that auction, and it's been on the second Saturday of October for, this will be its 50th year. Father McGuigan's connection to the community through, you know, the friendships he had formed through the cathedral, through the school, through West Valley, through golf, all have, I mean, he laid the groundwork, which was tremendous. He had the auction with the volunteers that he had was set up and ready to go. And I know people were really concerned in 2000, because he died in June of 2000. You know, what's going to happen? High Pal's not going to make it. And my response to that was, that's not fair to him and to his legacy, because what he did was set it up so that it could function without him. And people just picked up the pieces, the volunteers, the crew that he had working at Monroe Foundation at the time. We all worked together, picked up the pieces, and not just was HiPow 2000 successful, but it continued to build from there. Wouldn't have been possible without the groundwork he laid, but he did it so well that that's been able to go on since then.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Nancy Cook Hansen, who retired as director of the Catholic Schools of Fairbanks this summer. This weekend, she'll be attending the 50th HiPow fundraiser as a participant, not directing it. When we return from the break, leadership and goofy hats. Listening to Northern Soundings, I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. This episode, I'm talking with Nancy Cook Hansen, who stepped down this summer as director of the Catholic Schools of Fairbanks. Nancy is known for her thoughtful and resourceful leadership and for greeting young students outside the school every morning wearing some outlandish headgear. Let's get back to our conversation.
Well, besides being a really strong fundraiser, the other thing that people point to is your leadership, and you're a strong leader. Now, I have two parts to this question. Number one, to being a coach translate into skills being an administrator? And secondly, your ability to attract and keep strong, talented people despite the pay inequity that sometimes exists between the public sector and the school.
Starting with the first question, I think being a coach helped me, though I didn't actually end up teaching for very long, but I think being a coach helped me be a better teacher. And consequently, I think being a teacher helps a person be a better administrator. So the coaching piece, You try to teach a young person how to make a layup or how to make a good pass, and you really have to break it down into the fundamental skills. You have to be able to demonstrate. You have to be able to help kids understand why and how you broke it down and what the end result is. And that translates right back into the classroom of really being able to break, whether it's history, you break it down, you know, to the parts, to the people, to understanding how the people felt at the time. The same with math, you break it down to the basic skills and just keep building from there. And forming relationships. A successful team needs to sort of like one another and care for one another and support one another. And I used to tell the girls when I first started coaching, and I would be amazed at, you know, I'd say, well, why didn't you ever pass the ball to this girl? Well, I'm mad at her. So I had developed a process when I was coaching. I have a little box outside the gym door, and we would symbolically, I'd meet the girls at the door. If you're mad at somebody, put all your grudges, everything goes in the box. And when you walk in the gym, you have to tolerate and like everyone. And wow. that's kind of how it is in forming a staff. We may not always like one another, but we're going to work together. We're going to work for a common goal. And again, storytelling, I think, was a great way to work with teachers and, you know, to draw them along. Mm-hmm. I think one of the pieces that we noticed was missing in the mid-2000s, and by the time we got to 2005, 6, 7, 8, in there, 9, 10, was we needed to solidify our mission more. We needed to be able to point to this is who we are. And that began our quest to reconnect with our Jesuit roots. And that same, you know, all of that also pertains to fundraising. I don't think of myself as a premier fundraiser, but I like to form relationships with people. And that forming of friendships and trying to know and understand who our donors are and why they would want to give and wanting to have them have a connection to the school, I think that's been a major piece of what I've tried to do is to, once people have expressed an interest in the school, form relationships with them and keep in contact with them and let them know about what's happening here. Hiring teachers, that's, again, just a lot of Holy Spirit stuff. Often having the right people come and sometimes not. You know, there's been hard situations where we've had to let people go. But that question in the 2008 or 9, we formed a relationship with University of Portland. It started as a Holy Name school, Holy Cross, same as Notre Dame, Holy Cross priests. And they had a program called PACE, Pacific Alliance for Catholic Education. But they had young people who had graduated from college and wanted to work on their master's in education come to University of Portland. And to join that program, to be selected for that program, they had to also commit to teaching in a Catholic school for 2 years. So we became one of the Catholic schools where these young people would go. And so we have 4 PACE teachers every year, and they stay with us for 2 years as part of that program. So we have 2 in the elementary and 2 in the high school. And that gave us access to 4 young people. Granted, they are new teachers, so that presented a bit of a challenge, but they are Catholic, and they're enthusiastic about being in a Catholic school. So definitely, for the most part, they've been a blessing to us. We've also had to, you know, really be aware, because they're new teachers, helping them become better teachers. But that program has been fantastic for us, and we've had 2 or 3 of the teachers who've chosen to stay beyond their 2 years and to stay with us a 3rd or maybe a 4th year. So that's been really exciting, too. And that's helped us with young people believing when you're earning just part of a salary while you're part of that program, all of a sudden the salary seems bigger to them. We've really been lucky having teachers committed to the school, committed to the mission, and really wanting to teach in a Catholic school where it was smaller and easier to form teaching and coaching relationships and knowledge of the kids and with their families. And I think people really feeling like they can affect change and be able to talk about their curriculum. English teachers work with history teachers and with religion teachers. And those kinds of partnerships, I think, have really helped teachers feel like it's a good place to be.
What's ahead for Nancy? You're coming back in a couple of years?
I don't think I'll be back this time. I can't help but smile when I go back to this piece of the journey and knowing that Amanda Angayak has been really a part of that
walk. Who will become the director of schools.
She'll become the director of schools / president of Monroe Foundation. So we carry both titles. And she's been on this journey. Patrick Riggs, the junior senior high principal, has been on this journey. And Christy Parrish, who will be the new elementary school principal, has been with us on this journey. And Patrick, Amanda, and Christy, they've been working together. So they've been here. Those three have been working together. They've been together on this journey of who we are today and the mission. They've done curriculum projects together. They have such a strong sense of the school that I can't help but smile when I think of them as the leaders. And they have a great support group in Frank Ostanek as the athletic director, Kathleen Balco as the religion coordinator, Annie Krause as the lead counselor, and the office, Cass Cerny-Faree as the development director, and then the Monroe Foundation office and the school office. Tremendous people that we have really formulated and pulled together, strong teaching staff. So I just smile.
Well, the real test of leadership, will they show up every morning in front of the school with a funny hat on? You know, that's the key issue, which you were known to do.
That's my crazy piece, and that piece will walk away. And I really learned that piece from Coach Ostanek. He was the first to say, you know, we need somebody to greet. And he greets the kids who come in the gym parking lot door. And so the older kids generally come in that door. And he calls them all by name and has a funny line for them. And so I figured if he's doing that out back, somebody needs to do it out front. And it's really hard for elementary teachers we need them in their classrooms at 7:30.
Sure.
So I just said, you know, I'll do it. It'll be a fun way to see the families and greet. So I thought, okay, I'm not as funny as Coach O. I got to figure out something. I don't have one-liners like he has. So somewhere along the line, I started wearing hats. And then that was my creative side. People ask me how many hats I have. Well, I maybe had 40 basic hats, but duct tape was my friend. I could duct tape animals onto my hats. And then another great invention of late is those LED lights, you know, so you can have a battery pack, and I'd wrap myself in lights in the darkness, have Christmas lights all over me.
What an administrator won't do.
And so, duct tape, I don't know what I would have done without it, but the kids would enjoy it and look and see what I had. And it may be that parents enjoyed it more, and they loved it when I was lit up and they could see me from Illinois Street. And one little girl said, you need to be careful, you don't catch on fire. And I said, okay, I'll be pretty careful about that.
More time at the lake, do you think?
Yeah, I think I'll have a lot more time at the lake. And I enjoy my yard down the street here, so I'll have time there. And, you know, I think a piece for me, I will stay connected with the people, the Jesuit priests that I've formed relationships with, and likely begin training to become a retreat leader. The SEAL retreats they have, the spiritual exercises in everyday life. I'd like to be able to continue that process, learn more about that, become a leader in that sense, and stay connected with the folks there. Continuing my own faith life is critical to me. Lots of reading left to do. I have shelves of books, favorite authors. I will always be a hands-on reader, on my iPad or Nook reader, so continue in that and on my spiritual journey.
Well, Nancy Cook Hansen, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for asking questions.
A link to the Catholic Schools of Fairbanks HiPow page is on the Northern Soundings page. When we return from the break, the drive to depict nature. Thank you. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. Currently on display at the University of Alaska Museum of the North is a series of arresting and elegant paintings of Alaska wildflowers. They are the work of Fairbanks artist Karen Stomberg and are based on her recently published book, Collected Treasures. When I talked with Karen about the book and her exhibition, I began by asking when she knew she wanted to be an artist.
I think as soon as I was aware of having a crayon in my hand as a little kid, I was just drawn to drawing, to color, to seeing things. I was a really alert kid, which I don't think was the easiest thing for my parents necessarily. But, you know, I have very, very vivid memories of light and color, and probably from the age of two or three. And then by kindergarten, it was pretty much one of the things I really loved to do and always looked forward to art in school. We had lots of materials in our home. And
did your parents encourage this?
They did.
Yeah.
They did.
Were anybody in your family artists?
Well, my parents were both essentially scientists. My dad was an engineer. My mom was pre-med, but she stopped at chemistry because of World War II. She had to go into a lab and work and then got married and had kids. But my uncle went to Yale School of Drama, and they both loved art and they loved the natural world. They loved flowers and plants and trees. And my grandmother was an inveterate gardener. And we lived at my grandma's house in off and on when I was a child, because my dad's work as a young engineer took him to different places. And we always came back to grandma's house. And she had the most beautiful gardens. And I didn't know that. Everybody didn't have compost heaps to play in and, you know, wonderful bulbs coming up at different times in the spring and a huge beech tree that, you know, copper beech that filled the yard. So there was a lot of visual stimulus there. And then the church. We were part of a congregational church that was in walking distance, and there were bells that chimed at every hour, and the Sunday school was pretty, you know, rich with games and rhymes and drawing, but the church itself I loved. I loved the singing. At that time, there was a choir of about 120 voices. There was a, you know, it was the 50s and 60s is when I was growing up there, and a neighborhood full of kids. And so I loved the singing and being part of the choir and all the flowers on occasions. And there would be trumpets at Easter, and the building itself had Gothic arches inside. So there was always this kind of sense of wonder.
Where was this, Karen?
In Newton, Massachusetts, so mm-hmm. a suburb of Boston. And Newton is a series of villages that were settled after Boston was settled.
As your education continued,
yep.
Did you major in art?
I did. So I took art all the way through middle school. And then in high school, there was a really good art program. It was really strong. There were three art teachers. And so I took a lot of art, 3D and 2D. And then in my senior year, probably one of the most influential teachers for me, his name was Sam Bassell, and he was actually a student teacher from Yale. So Sam brought a whole lot of interesting notions, and he was a wonderful art history teacher. So I took a whole year of art appreciation with him. And so we did slide after slide after slide, which was fascinating to me. Some people might have hated it, but I just was immersed in it. And it helped me to understand the world, to see all of this art from all different cultures and talk about it and learn the words to talk about it. And so, and then learn color and color theory. It was wonderful to me. So when I launched into the world, which was 1967, the year of love, you know, that was a year that things really flipped. I went to school at UMass Boston. I stayed at home and commuted by subway right into Arlington Center. And UMass Boston was fledgling. It was only in its third year. It was drawing wonderful professors from all over the city. So there were all these really interesting people that I met as a suburban kid at a high school where there were cheerleaders, and I could play field hockey and lacrosse and all of these things and have this real enriched curriculum. And then I was able to take art history and work in the art history library. And at that time, we had slides of everything. Mm. And so my job was to put the slides between two little pieces of glass and then put this Mylar tape all the way around the edges and crimp them so that they could, you know, it was really exacting.
Yeah.
But it was wonderful. You know, I mean, I really enjoyed
it. It's actually, I would guess, great preparation for a storehouse of images.
Right.
When did you come to Alaska?
1972.
Okay. And what drew you here?
Oh, I'd been fascinated with Alaska since I was really young, reading Call of the Wild and adventure stories and just attracted to the North. I heard a lecture from Bradford Washburn at some time early on at UMass Boston. And so in 1970, there were the student strikes and things closed down and there was a lot of mayhem happening. And I spent a summer in Europe and that sort of gave me a different perspective on the United States and on the kind of life I had been educated to have. I could travel. I could take some time out. You know, I didn't have to go directly into a job teaching in a Boston school. And I had my teaching certificate at that point and went with friends in a van, a Greenbrier van. It was a pretty wonderful trip.
Oh, I'll bet it.
All the way up across the top of Canada and down. And then we got on the ferry and got off at Juneau. And I met a pretty well-known Alaskan person there who said, well, if you are looking for a job as a teacher, you know, at this point, kids are allowed, you know, learn in their own villages. And so I can introduce you to Dr. Ray Barnhard, who's at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he could probably help place you. So we came to Fairbanks. And the day that I came to see Ray at the Eielson building, he was on the phone, so I wandered down the hall to Umingmak, which is the Muskox Producers Cooperative. And as life in Alaska happens, there were a lot of opportunities, and that was mine. I stepped into it about 6 days after arriving in Alaska. Mm. And the Ginger Bame, who at that time was their textile specialist, said, you know, I am leaving for Tierra del Fuego on a motorcycle with my boyfriend in 2 weeks. She said, maybe you should go down to HR and see if the job's available. So I did, and I got the job.
You're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm talking with the artist and retired educator Karen Stomberg. She has an exhibit currently running at the University of Alaska Museum of the North. When we return from the break, the art of illustration. Welcome back. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. I'm talking this episode with Karen Stomberg. She has a new book and exhibition on display at the University of Alaska Museum of the North entitled Collected Treasures, Six Alaska Wildflowers. As we continued our conversation, I asked her what drew her to the subject.
I have gone through a lot of phases, but always use the natural world as my touchstone for drawing, I'm pretty sure. And love to work outside, to do plein air painting for a long time, and learned printmaking. But it was always sort of based in the natural world and in plants and in flowers, just loving the beauty of both wildflowers and flowers that I could grow. And I also have a love of Japanese artwork. Mm. And since college, actually, you know, when I first started looking, I loved the white space because a lot of times Japanese prints have a lot of white space. And so the negative space, the space around the object is really important. And I love that look and the spareness of it and almost the flatness of the space. A lot of times in especially historical Japanese art, there's not a lot of deep space. And so the old engravings of botanical art have always interested me as well because they have those same qualities in a way. There's a flatness to them, and the way that they're designed and the composition on the page is really important. So the white space is very important. And very beautiful. I think that my natural sensibility, when I'm moving things around on a page, when I'm trying to figure out how to do it, ends up in a way using that white space so that it's dynamic. It becomes part of the dynamism. And yet many contemporary botanical artists are incredibly adept at making things very three-dimensional and moving out of the paper and creating every detail in this absolutely lush and incredible way that isn't my goal, whether it's within my ability or not, because this is very new to me, working this precisely. I would say that my choice really is to almost recreate, in a sense, the feeling of the older botanicals that come from the pages of books and that were created actually from specimens frequently. And so that quality, I think, ends up in my final drawings, even though I'm working from live plants, you know. So,
but it also elevates them as totems almost. There's something emblematic about them. So are these plants more than just these clinical specimens for you?
They really are. And I realize that more and more as I draw them. I'm going to open up a broader sort of argument or discussion that's happening in the world. What is the difference between a botanical illustrator and a botanical artist? Hmm. And a botanical illustrator has more of a goal to completely replicate in every detail all the morphological stages of a plant's growth so that there's a very unambiguous identification possible. And those can be quite beautiful. But a botanical artist, I think that the consensus is that a botanical artist still needs to create a specimen that conforms to what's there so that it shows the leaves and it shows the specific details of what that plant is so that the plant can also be identified. But there's more artistic license and less need for all of the morphology. So not every stage of development of that plant necessarily needs to be part of a drawing. Mm. And there's getting to be more openness about what kind of background. Sometimes they're in the setting, you know, in the rich setting of where you would find it in the natural world. But mostly the convention is that there is no background. A lot of times people are using vellum now, real vellum. So there's a tone to the background that's different. But their conventions are that the specimens are lit from the upper left-hand side, and you'll see that. I mean, you'll see anomalies, but that's the tradition. And that you show the connections of the stem to the leaf. And so you need to show the pieces, how things are connected. You know, you'll see an open petal so that you can see inside the flower. Usually you need to have the flower. And one leaf would be flipped over so you can see the back of the leaf as well as the front of the leaf. But Wendy Hollander's book, Drawing in Color, was one that I really could relate to. There are many books about doing botanical art, which I realized that it was really a pleasure to me to kind of learn those rules. And again, it was an influential teacher that completely changed the way I'm doing my art right now.
Yes, talk to me about that. When it came to creating Collected Treasures, how did that process work for you?
What happened was that I was intending to do an exhibition catalog for Collected Treasures 6 Alaska Wildflowers. And I had gotten a grant from the Rasmussen Foundation, which was lovely, an individual artist grant. And I had set aside $1,000 of that to create an exhibit brochure. But in the process of drawing what I was drawing and getting interested in who drew them, who these people were, where these plants came from, about the places, about the people, the stories behind the collectors, I learned so much about these plants that was steeped in history from the collections from 1899. The Harriman Alaska Expedition was the last major expedition of that type, and John Muir was on that expedition, and Edward Curtis, and John Burroughs, and many young scientists and artists and statesmen, and they were on this ship together for a very long time, and they collaborated in mind. So it was a wonderful opportunity for all of these people to come together and see Alaska and collect Alaska and write about Alaska, and also to go back to the expeditions in 1742, the very first expeditions, and see what had happened in the ensuing years. And so they made amazing observations about the changes that they saw you know, and the early explorers and how that had opened up Alaska. And in the 150 intervening years, what had happened. So I learned so much through the people who collected and what happened on that voyage. And then with the University of Alaska Fairbanks specimens, I realized that many of the people who were collecting were serving as bellwethers in a way of change and what they were seeing. And a lot of times it was, you know, because they were doing exploration ahead of extraction, you know, for mines, for oil. And at some point in the 90s, there was a lot of money from the U.S. government to do these floristic inventories of all of their land. So there was a huge effort to collect specimens at that time. All of those kinds of stories seemed really important to me. There were a lot of environmental stories, a lot of very sad stories from early on. And then I realized that the fresh plants were, and my choices were very connected to my own personal history. So there were stories that I wanted to tell. And I started envisioning doing a book rather than
a catalog.
And so that's how it grew. And then because I love the collaboration of writers with people who are artists, I asked Kes Woodward if he would help write. And also he was on the second Harriman expedition, the 100 year. And so he did. And I asked Frank Sos if he would write. And the wonderful thing is, because what I was writing was almost like, oh, I was writing like thesis stuff. My writing seems kind of stiff. And so Frank said, yeah, you know, the essay form is kind of nice for getting at things from a different angle. So he wrote a wonderful essay, which I'm so pleased he did. And then I asked Susan Campbell if she would write a poem to sort of frame the book. And it ended up that this book became a collaboration. My friend Nikki Eisman helped me a lot with just organizing it. And Elise Guttenberg came in at the end to help with the final kinds of things that you need to do before you publish a book. What kinds of things do you need? And at the beginning, Margot Klass helped me with the flow of the book. What does a book need to be a book?
Yeah. Well, I'm talking right now with Karen Stomberg. She has a book out, Collected Treasures, Six Alaska Wildflowers, and she has an exhibit at the University of Alaska Museum of the North. You can find that in the cafe mounted on the walls there. Karen, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Robert.
Karen is also teaching a workshop on botanical illustration at the museum on October 15th and 16th. Links to the museum are on the Northern Soundings website. That's it for this episode of Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. I hope you'll join me again in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.